Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang dhammang sangham namassami. All right. Audio's okay?
Right.
Video's okay? All right. Good, good. Very good. So I hope you had a fruitful day, an edifying day. Here it's morning and it's sloppy. This we call sloppy weather. Everything is melting and the mist is coming off the snow, evaporate, and it's all slushy and sloppy. So, midway through the retreat, I usually find I don't want to say anything more and just leave you to meditate because there's the too many ideas, of course, becomes a kind of overload. I mean, each of these ideas, it takes quite a long time to process them because they're simple enough to present. But the subtlety of their application and the challenge or the challenge to your own viewpoint, say, you have to consider, not that my viewpoint is right or wrong. It's more that, you have to kind of look in your own mind and say, well, what do I think about that? Does that fit in what works for me? Or, well, I didn't look at it that way. So that's the whole realm of reflection, and that you can't do that just by listening to one talk. You have to mull it over, consider it, take it into your practice, and that takes time. So too many ideas just get kind of overwhelmed. And I had that one where I was just my early days of retreats. I did one retreat north of Toronto, and every day I'd give another list. And by the sixth day, someone wrote a note, enough with the lists, please. This is too much. It's great, but I can't take it anymore. So that's because Theravada has a lot of lists, you might have noticed, right? And so, so my, what can I, bedtime stories is when I start now. But the context of all of this training that we do is for me in the context I learned this was in, of course, Wat Pa Phong, and then laterally at Wat Nanachat and Chittu Viveka in England and so on, other monasteries. And it's always in the context of normal life. And normal life, obviously, monasticism is a much a quieter life than lay life. Lay life is much more busy with a lot more inputs and things like that. But Ajahn Chah's emphasis was on ordinariness, being present to the ordinary situations of life. And he really emphasized doing things carefully, doing things beautifully. And so one of the things that was like good for me to learn around my work habits. So in the Isan, the most of the monks that I was with in the Isan in those early years were from farming families, and they really knew how to work. Not just work hard, but work with quite a lovely spirit. They're quite actually fun to work with. They knew how to work as a community, and they knew how to work as a group, and they had all these different skills. So most of the monks could weave a basket or build a kuti or whatever. They had all the skills of the innovativeness of a farming community. They could take things and make things very beautifully. So that sense of how, like for me, one of my habits was work was something I always had to get finished. so that I could meditate. And then, of course, that's a very it's an attitude that does not bring peace. It just brings sort of a kind of restlessness to the mind. So then I'd rush to get some work finished, and then I'd have to sit for the next hour with that mind, which I had created because I had bad work habits. And so working with the with the Thai monks, the Isan monks up in Ubon, I learned about a habit which wasn't, you know, which wasn't just about work. It was just the way I functioned in the world. I was getting something done. I was getting something done to do the next thing. And that's a lot of the learning that we do in life, which also comes up in your meditation. And so the idea that you're kind of getting something done, or you're reaching some goal, or, I mean, that's very, very ordinary and actually very important. If you have a business contract, or you have to finish an essay at university, you have to get things done, you know. But the meditative process that we're involved in is to do things carefully for the sake of doing them, meditate for the sake of meditation. And so what you want to look at in your own, in the way you make effort is it about, and these things can be so ingrained, so deeply embedded in our attitudes to doing things that we maybe don't notice them. It's so part of our life. So there's the kind of famous, you know, the famous story you read of Lompo Sumedho, and he's tired of sweeping leaves, because at Wapapong, or all the monasteries, there's always these leaves falling. Now all our leaves are gone, so there's no leaves to sweep for 6 months. But in Wapapong, they're always falling, and you're always sweeping. And I think Lompo, he tells that funny story where he's really grumbling. I don't want to sweep leaves. I want to meditate. And Lompo Cha can see that he's feeling disgruntled, and he looks up at him. He says, "How does it feel, Sumedho?" And so Lompo's idea was, you know, meditation is the serious stuff, and you really got to work at it. And he was very diligent. And this other stuff, work and being with people, and is a nuisance, right? I want to meditate. And so he tells that funny story. And an attitude like that can be very obvious to others, huh? But maybe not obvious to ourselves. So the kind of idea of doing things carefully, bowing carefully, taking care of your shrine. At the monastery, we have a really strong tradition of cleanliness, as simple as that. So, you know, I think you've all heard the story when Lompo Cha would say, if you want to see if it's a good monastery, if the monastery is rip-roy, check the toilets. You know, and yeah, it's true, actually. When you see a rip-roy monastery, if you go to a monastery and the toilets are all messy, you think, well, these monks, what are they doing? How can they be, you know, mindful? And so the ethos at Wapapong and all our monasteries is everything is important. All the activities are important. Walking from A to B is important. And important in a way which is normal and ordinary. And that brings a kind of care of the things that, so like as monks, everything here has been given. My robes, my body, all the food in my body that I've eaten now for 45 years. I hope it's still not there. But the transformation of the elements in my body, and this lamp and this bell and the Buddha Rupa and everything has been given by the generosity of lay people. And so that's a kind of beautiful reflection of care for things, you know, care for the books and care for the floor and care for the grounds. And then that, of course, enhances the meditation practice. It's not separate. It's not separate at all. And one of the things we learn, or we are trained in and asked to practice, is upatak, where a junior monk takes care of a senior monk. And that's really beautiful for Westerners, because that's not something we are in tune with. You know, we tend to be very, very independent, and you know, elderly people even say, "Well, I'm okay, leave me alone, I'm independent." So, but at the monastery, we pick up on these Thai values and the Buddhist values. And so Venerable Vipassi, who's running the computer here, he's my upatak, and he's fabulous. He really takes care of me, and he's embarrassed. No, he's not. but it's true. I mean, it creates this lovely sense of kalyanamitta, doesn't it? And that's important for meditation, isn't it? That there's a heartfelt sense of community, and there's a heartfelt sense of caring for each other. And so that's interesting, being in Western society where, well, people are friendly, but the idea of upatak or that is rather foreign. It's not, people don't take care of each other, but that training that we get, like what we're trained to do as junior monks to in relating to senior monks, our upachaya or our acharya, is to actually anticipate the needs of a teacher. And that's interesting, where you have to be so mindful of your teacher, and you watch what he's doing, and you watch his preferences and where he might have difficulties physically, and then you initiate something to help in that, which is making the meditation not just an internalized process of me doing my practice, but an integration to all of life in a natural way that brings forth beauty and well-being. So the danger I've seen in Western society is that meditation becomes a kind of selfish idea. You know, I'm doing my practice, and leave me alone, I'm meditating. Leave me alone, I'm doing metta bhavana. That's a classic. If you think of the paradox there, leave me alone, I'm spreading loving kindness to you. and it's a good example, isn't it? So you know that it's a very easy to do that. And why do we do that? I think it's because we mistake refinement, and that refinement of the mind as the goal, rather than the still knowing, which knows coarseness and refinement. Because coarseness can be known. So some of life is coarse. Some of social discourse is coarse, and traffic noise and air pollution, those are coarse things on the senses. But the refinement of like a sunrise here, or the silence of winter, or the spaciousness, these are refined sense experiences. But awareness is okay with both. So one of the dangers of meditation is you get very good at refining it, the quality of mind through anapanasati or whatever, and then you think that's the goal. And then you hold on to that perception that this is the goal, and then you begin to be annoyed by other things, and that's a sign. If anything is annoying you in your meditative process, then look at the annoyance as an object in awareness. So refinement is fine, it can be very, very restful, but it's not the goal. And notice that awareness is not, it knows refinement, it knows coarseness, and that's different. So one of the questions that came up in the chat line was, what is the difference between satipanya and satisampajanya, right? Is that it? Yeah. And again, I'm not a Pali scholar, so I guess satisampajanya would be, our English translations tend to have it as mindfulness and clear comprehension, and satipanya is mindfulness and wisdom. So you get these different ways of kind of describing, but they're just words, right? And you don't need an exact definition of the Pali words to understand. What you need is a kind of reflective capacity which can use words as a way of understanding this moment. So it's not the understanding of words that's important. It's the understanding of your experience and the attachment to your experience and the dukkha that causes. So I know some people like to pick apart, like this word means exactly this and that word means exactly that. So say one of the debates that goes on in English translations of Pali is the word dukkha. So you get suffering and you get stress and you get unsatisfactoriness, and then people argue which is right. What does it really matter? You know, what it matters, it's pointing to something. So the pointers rather than absolutes. And that's where you get into dogma, don't you? Where someone will say, well, this means exactly that, it doesn't mean this. And so people argue at an intellectual level, and that's dogmatism. And dogmatism is holding to views. And we're not holding on to the views of Buddhism. We're trying to practice samadhi, right understanding, rather than just attaching to views about Buddhism. And that's where people who might be card-carrying Buddhists, who have a real affinity to Buddhism, they just believe it. You know, they believe in anicca dukkhanatta, whatever that might be. Or they believe that the Buddha was enlightened, or they believe that they cannot get enlightened. That's a common one. And that's really not understanding. It's just holding a position. And then they can get in conflict with others, either in Buddhist circles or with other religious circles. But that's missing the whole point. So reflection is this capacity to take some language, satisampajanya, satipanya, and internalize it in your own way. And the internalization of the Four Noble Truths is the essence of the contemplative structure that we use to come to the understanding that the Buddha had. And that, you know, the analogy that I really like about the Four Noble Truths is the analogy of the skin disease, right? And I often talk about that. And in a skin disease, it's, you know, you reflect on it, a skin disease, let's say a skin disease which causes itching, right? And just to reiterate that example, when you have like poison ivy or one of these skin diseases, the desire is to scratch, and the scratching feels good, but the scratching creates more rash, and the more rash creates more scratching. And that's a really, really good analogy to how tanha works. Tanha is the itching. The disease is vipaka kamma. It's the habit of seeking external objects. And that seeking of objective experiences, a pleasure and getting away from pain, that's the kind of disease we're into. And that's vipaka kamma. That's just the result of our conditioning, our biological conditioning, our social conditioning. And then we enter into this path as contemplatives and meditators, and we feel this itching, and we want to scratch, because that's what we've always done. We've always scratched. So if I feel anxious about the future, I worry. So the anxiety about the future is vipaka kamma. It's the habit of thinking about the future in negative ways, because the future can be disastrous, we don't know. So that habit then gets reinforced by worry. So worry is the scratching, correct? And then you start to meditate, you start to see, well, you know, I always do this. I did it last year, I did it last month, I did it 2 years ago. It's actually not about the problem of the future, it's about the habit of mind. And that's a huge awakening. And that's one way you might think of satipanya or satisampajanya. You understand that this is a habit, not an absolute reality. It's a habit of conscious experience, of mind, that keeps coming up in my experience. So that's what satisampajanya is about, or satipanya is about. You clearly comprehend the problem. Yeah, you understand dukkha. And then from that, you start to see, okay, so how do I put an end to the disease? And that's the Buddha's teaching, is how do you put an end to the disease? You stop scratching. And that's so hard to do, right? Because the scratching does feel good. If the scratching didn't feel good, you wouldn't do it. So the short-term result of scratching is, that feels great. So the short-term result of worry, it feels like you're solving the problem, but you're not, because you're still in the habit. That's different than functional thinking. Functional planning, that's necessary. But say anxious worry, the first instance of it, the first habit of it, feels good because you feel like you're resolving the problem. But then what you do is you exacerbate the disease, and the habit just keeps going and going and going. So at some point you have to break the habit of scratching. That's really hard. That's really, really hard because the other feels good. It has, so, you know, if you've ever had a skin disease and you're like, I've had poison ivy, and when you take a hot shower with poison ivy, you just want to scratch it and it feels wonderful. But then you come out of the shower and your arm is red and raw. You can't do that. So you put ice on it or whatever. So what you have to ask yourself is, what are your patterns of itching and scratching? What kind of scratching do you have to let go of for the mind to realize the end of the disease? And that's Nirodha, where the disease ends. And these are very personal things. But let's say like something like a lot of people in the West, they here in Canada, they have a strong idealism. They attach to idealism, like I should be a good person, I should be generous, I should love everyone, or something very over the top ideal. And then the reality is the vipaka kamma of aversion, annoyance, resentment, jealousy come up into consciousness. And then rather than just know, that's the itching, they jump into the scratching, which is self-disparagement. I'm a terrible person. I shouldn't feel jealous. I shouldn't feel angry. I'm a bad monk, or I'm a bad mother. And that's the scratching, because that feels good. That feels good, even though it's perverse. So then just to bear witness to the itching of something like resentment, where you don't want it, you want to get rid of it, and yet you want to blame the person, just to know it as an uncomfortable, unpleasant kind of experience and not attach to it with getting rid of it or blaming yourself, is the beginning of the end of the disease. And that's of course what I didn't understand at Wapapong in the early days, is that how powerful these habits are. And that's why Lompa Cha's constant encouragement, or Ton, this will change, hang in there, or his laughter or his good humor, kind of kept me in the game. But it was seriously disturbing, you know, to feel angry at a monk because he got a bigger mango than me. You know, it was like, I was number 50 of 50 monks and novices, and I'd look down the line and the Kuba Ajahns would always get 3 cakes. And then when it got to me, I had no cakes. I thought, that's not fair. Or someone would get 2 mangoes, and I, you know, it was childish. It was childish, and yet there it was. I felt so embarrassed by it. And yet it was a real emotion. And Lompa, you know, he said, well, you haven't changed your mind. Oton. And then, you know, that's the itching, isn't it? These habits, these itching. And the, for me, the scratching of that was self-hatred and self-disparagement. You know, you shouldn't be like that. You should be more cool. You should be like Lompa Liam or whatever. And it's getting these patterns of itching and scratching into focus is part of Satisampajanya, mindfulness and clear comprehension. You understand the patterning of your suffering, huh? And whatever, it might be cultural, or it might be individual, it might be gender conditioning, it might be whatever way it's conditioned, many, many ways. And you could see then the refuge of knowing is brilliant, because knowing can know even, you know, uncomfortable habits. If you take the extreme of addictions, say obsessive compulsive disorder, or various kinds of drug addictions, or those kinds of things, you see how very difficult it is for people to get out of that, because the itching is so very, very powerful. Now, the kind of ultimate scratching that we are trying to notice and not buy into is the atavada, the self-view, the me and mine, the ahankara mimankara. That is the ultimate, or that is the shall we say, the root indication of the disease, the root cause for the, I'm trying to get my words out here, the root cause of the perpetuation of the disease. It's the I thinking, my thinking. And again, saying, like I always say, that letting go is not, you know, when we talk about letting go, it doesn't mean that the itching stops. It means you don't indulge in the scratching. So when I felt fear at giving Dhamma talks when I was a younger monk, that wasn't detachment. That was vipakakamma. The attachment was, what am I going to say? And did they like what I say? Or I'll never say anything again. The atavada, the ahankara, vimankara. And this is the word papancha. Papancha, someone asked the question, what is papancha? Papancha is that picking, it's the scratching. You know, it's the scratching of the vipakakamma, of the itching, of the disease. So for me, the papancha, say, in terms of fear, in public settings and giving Dhamma talks, the fear was not, that wasn't an attachment. I had no choice. You know, you could say, well, someone could say to me, Ploy Wong, and I mistook Ploy Wong to mean, well, I shouldn't be having that. But that's not Ploy Wong, that's Vibhava Tanha, that's getting rid of. So Ploy Wong, it took me a while to understand, is the papancha, the Prungdang in Thai, yeah, if I have the tone right. I can never get the tone right. Prungdang, or someone's got it. Everyone, you know. There you go. Okay. It's brilliant, isn't it? That's a brilliant way to describe upadana in the Pali, or attachment. It's the scratching. So you have to differentiate that the coming, arising of difficult material, like whatever I talked about, fear, resentment, it's not your fault. It's your responsibility. If you don't deal with it, it'll just get worse. But it's just vipakakamma. It's paticca samuppada. It's dependently originated. So in that moment of noticing it, what are the causes for the liberation or the eradication of that disease? Huh? And that's patient endurance. I'm not going to thought. Going to the real feeling, or right thinking, it feels this way, it feels this way, it feels this way. Yeah? So try to get that in terms of papancha and satipanya or satisampajanya. That's what we're pointing to. It's like the intelligence that we have, not just abstract intelligence about external things, but the intelligence we have about our own conditioning. And we can only know that each individually, you know, for ourselves. So then once you sort of diagnose the problem like that, and you see that, okay, I get it. Okay, this fear is the itching, and the papancha is the scratching. Well, that doesn't mean that the disease is already over. That's just the beginning. So you have that insight, but still the vipakakamma of the disease keeps coming through you. And it's the same with like poison ivy. Even though I knew that if I put ice on it or chamomile lotion or whatever, and I didn't scratch it, I knew that was the methodology and that was the eventual cure. I still had to bear with it. It might last for like a few weeks. The itching was still there, and so that is what we have to bear with. Even though you see what the problem is, it doesn't mean that it's that easy. Otherwise, it wouldn't take a Buddha to realize this. And so all the language of be patient or ton, and also creating other things in your mind which create a sense of well-being. So dana and sila and quiet meditation, all of that helps you to bear with the vipakakamma. But not to underestimate the power of that. And I find if I can remind myself, I say, well, this is just dependently originated. When this trigger comes, then this arises. So, and that's the way I would work with the fear. I'd be in my kuti, no fear, no problem. And then someone would say, you have to give up talk at a funeral next week. Oh no! The Vipakakama would come up. It got triggered by this idea of me having to give a talk. And then there'd be the fear. And then there'd be the pancha and all of that. And say, fear feels this way, fear feels this way, it feels this way. And have to go back, oton, oton. Then I'd give the talk. And then I'd even be more afraid. And then after the talk, I would criticize myself. No, it feels this way. And that whole cycle, right? I just keep watching and watching. And that was the disease. It wasn't my fault. Right? If I had a choice, I'd say, no, I'm not going to do this, but I didn't have a choice. Huh? So that's why we talk about dependent origination, paticca samuppada. You know, like we replace the sense of I am afraid with that which is the I sense, which is true. You know, I'm afraid, not you, but that sort of taking it personally or blaming myself, we replace that with dependent origination. We say, with this as condition, that arises. When there's this, there's that. With this not as condition, that doesn't arise. When there isn't this, there isn't that. We call it this, that conditionality. And it's true, isn't it? Like you don't plan to be afraid or to be angry or whatever. It's just the causes and conditions poke you and the vipakakama comes into consciousness. And that's the itching, right? And as the itching there, then your challenge is not to attach to the I thinking. And that's what I would see as non-attachment is, non-grasping. But a lot of people mistake it and they think, oh, if I'm just mindful, I won't have these experiences. No, sorry. not anyone I know. Even Lompa Cha, you know, if you read that, his experiences with lust were profoundly difficult to deal with, right? And he had been a monk for many years. And so that's a very good example. You can have all the parami of a great meditator and a great teacher, but still vipakakama is still there. So keep in mind how we use dependent origination rather than I have a problem. It's just this emotion arises with these causes and conditions. So then lifestyle, like if your lifestyle exacerbates the disease, you know, and it somehow just not only does the disease or the itching get triggered, but it gets worse, right? Then you have to look at your lifestyle, otherwise you get overwhelmed. But no lifestyle is going to free you from the arising of these things because they have a power of their own. So lifestyle isn't about running away. Like some people think monks are running away from life. Well, they soon find out that whatever vipakakama habits they have, they come out. So if they hated someone, if they had a lot of hatred in lay life, they'll find someone to hate in the monastery. You know, hatred is not proud. It'll pick anyone. and so they'll see, oh, yeah, this isn't about running away. It's about waking up to something. So we don't want to, you know, we don't want to live a life of fear, but we do want to live a life where we have enough mindfulness and situation where when vipakakama arises, when the symptoms of the disease arise, we have enough awareness to process it so that the disease ends. And that's that, you know, when people talk about right lifestyle, that's the kind of area I always ask them. I said, do you get overwhelmed by your habits? Do they get worse? Or when your habits are triggered, do you have the situation to actually work with them, process them, and become more free from them? And that's a good thing, right? That's a good thing. So these are, you know, these are very personal things. One can't say how it could be. But having something triggered is not a bad thing. So for me, my example, the triggering of fear was actually a very, very good thing because it was safe. Because I could contemplate it, because I wouldn't lose my job if I didn't do it right. So I had all the situation actually to be able to look at the I Ching. Huh? In another situation, maybe, you know, if I'm out in the woods and a bear comes towards me, I'm not going to say, oh, please, I want to look at my fear, right? I'm not that stupid. Or there's danger in some way. So it's like reasonable kind of fears or whatever you're experiencing. So do look at that, you know, look at the inner turmoil you have as first of all dependently originated, not your fault. And then from that, what are the causes and conditions for you to awaken to it in the future or now? And what kind of language can you use to be patient with it? And how would the ceasing of it slowly, how might that work? So really understanding your own it's your own laboratory, isn't it? It's the place where your problems are the place of enlightenment. You know, obviously, that's how else could it be? The place of enlightenment for me was my own fears, my own resentments, and such like. So that's if you get that, the difference between what attachment really means, I think that's very important. It's much misunderstood, very, very much misunderstood. So then when you understand that, you see the tanha is something that like the question that we had earlier, where the person felt a peaceful, but they didn't feel happy, right? So they had this concept of happiness. And the thing about peace is that tanha is not interested in peace. Because peace is the non-attachment to objects. It's the puru, it's the ru behind the whole thing. And tanha is always the energy looking for excitement or rejecting things. And it's a kind of outward going energy. So peace is not interesting for tanha. So even though you feel peaceful, right? Tanha will still arise because that's the habit. That's the vipaka kamma. And it'll bring up doubt or it'll bring up fantasy in your mind. And so you're continually awakening to this movement outwards. And so that idea that the mind going outwards is the problem. The mind knowing the mind is the end of the problem. That's a very good analogy. So I feel... Let's say I feel fear. Let's say fear comes up. The mind going outward would be the believing in the fear and the thinking about the fear and the papancha around the fear. The mind knowing the mind would be, oh, fear feels this way. It's like this, binyang ni eng, and trusting in that, being patient with that. All right, so I think that's okay. Something for you to contemplate, you know, not to have too much. Were there any written questions from the group, Yongpeng, or? Okay, we have some questions here. So is that, yeah. Besides stopping scratching of my own mind habit, how can I help my mother's worry habits while she keeps suffering and complaining with her own itchiness? Well, the challenge with, I think, close relationship is you want your mother to be something else. So that's a good thing. You don't want her to suffer, but there's also a kind of wanting that you attach to because it's annoying. Maybe she worries or you worry that she worries. So first of all, you have to work with your own wanting and make conscious this feeling, mom, I don't want you to be mom. I want you to be an arahant. Thank you very much. But mom is not an arahant. And mom is paticca samuppada. Her habits are dependently originated. It's not her fault. It might be annoying or worrying to you, but it's not her fault. So just to tell her or ask her, stop worrying, mom. Don't worry about it. Nothing to worry about. isn't going to help. And actually, it'll be a kind of a cruelty, because she, in some sense, she has no choice until she can awaken, right? So what you're trying to do is not so much stop a person from being a person and with a personality, and that you're trying to awaken them to suffering and the habits of suffering. So to do that, you have to, first of all, let go of your own, let's say, you have to be very conscious that you're not doing this just because you don't like it. If I don't like you the way you are, and I start to implement my Dharma teaching on top of you, so you change for me, that's called tyranny, right? That's not metta, that's me wanting you to be something different from me. No, that's cheating. And that's where we use Dharma as a kind of bludgeon. You know, stop it, you're not being a good Buddhist, or whatever it is. So first and foremost, you have to be very honest and say, you know, I don't like this. And it could be a very good reason. You don't, you know, you're worried for your mom. You want your mom to be happy. But first of all, you have to come, I don't like this. And you come to a sense of, this is the feeling of not wanting or not liking. And then you get a sense of acceptance of this situation. Okay, this is the way it is. And then you see, how can you enter into this person's dependently originated habits and introduce some form of awakening? And usually that's done through listening. So, you know, someone, you know, has something and you say, oh yeah, yeah. And they're complaining about this and complaining about that. That's very tiring, I realize, very, very tiring. So then you say, well, yeah, does that put a lot of tension in your shoulders? Or do you get headaches when you think like this? So now you're questioning the person, but you're leading them into the field of body awareness or something, and they become more objective to their suffering. That, you know, that would be the skill of counseling or the skill of listening. But you have to be careful to not, you know, some people are so habituated to their itching and scratching, you're not going to get much movement this lifetime. I'm sorry, right? You know, even though it's logical, their mind is so conditioned and their reflective capacities might be minimal or less than yours, that there isn't going to be much movement. There isn't going to be much change. So then you have to have strategies of, like, I suppose, distraction or thinking about something else or whatever. And it takes a lot of patience to speak with people who don't have a reflective mind. Like, you know, to speak to someone who's really, like, believes in racism or believes in conspiracy theories and all this stuff that goes on, they're very hard to talk to because they don't have a reflective mind. They just believe in their opinions. So someone whose vipaka kamma is such that they cannot be objective to their fears and worries, very hard. It's very, very hard to address that. So if that's the case, whatever the case, deal with your own suffering first. I don't want this. And say, yeah, but it's like this. Resolve the wanting in your own heart, and then you're available for the best solution. But the best solution might not be very satisfying because the situation is as it is, right? Yeah, and to see someone you love going off into unnecessary tangents of suffering, it's very painful. It's so unnecessary, but there you go. That's the way it is. Do you have another one? That's it. All right. So someone's asking if these talks will be up. They'll be on our website, I think, or something. We'll figure something out. Any questions from the floor, Yong Peng? You got one. Okay. Oh, here we go. Okay. In the Ottawa retreat, you said you use boundless compassion as your touchstone to remind you of the awakening mind. Can you tell us more about that? So what I was referring to is something you might have heard me talk about. In my early years of monasticism, I had a lot of fear and a lot of self-disparagement, a lot of self-criticism. So they're very, very negative states of mind, and they're very powerful. So I tried to develop language which would help me bear witness to them in ways where I wasn't judging or trying to get rid of. And so I just developed like an inner mantra of infinite patience, boundless compassion. Because compassion was the acceptance part, right? I had to accept this is vipaka kamma, and that countered the judging mind, you know, the kind of critical judging, you're not doing it right. And then the infinite patience was the enduring, the otton, infinite patience, like not just today, but forever. And boundless compassion was like this expansiveness. And so that was language that I kept bringing up, and that created the attitude to bear witness to difficult things. And I had to do it a lot because these difficult things, this strong itching, was very powerful, and it would, you know, would kind of take over my thinking mind. And then I'd remember, and then I'd write it down. You know, I'd write it in big letters and put it on my table. And then I would say it, infinite patience, and I'd say it very slowly, infinite patience, boundless compassion. And again, that to me speaks to samasankapa, right thinking. I understood the problem then. I kind of understood it. I got confused by it, but I kind of got the idea, okay, this is going to take some time. And I saw the habits of thought, but there they were. So then from that insight, panya, right, I developed samasankapa, a language, words, which helped me to remember the insight, helped me to remember the right practice, helped me to remember samasati, and so on and so forth. So as I say, the whole path is always working together. So infinite patience, boundless compassion. It was really good, you know, really, really, really very, very helpful. I did it for, you know, quite a few years, because it became like we call a touchstone. You touch the stone and you remember something. And so it was a language that reminded me of something I understood already and relaxed the mind. Not that it was always effective. Sometimes it just became a parrot talking. Infinite patience, boundless compassion, you know. So to bring up the authenticity of it, I had to say it really slowly. Infinite patience. Because all of this stuff, you can just be saying infinite patience, boundless compassion, and getting angry at the monk next to you, right? It's not. It always has to have this kind of sincerity in it and authenticity. So that was so those things, say like Thich Nhat Hanh, he uses arigatas, or people will use the like phrases from the Dhammapada, which they find very, very helpful. Or maybe like a word like akaliko, timeless. These can, you know, if they are part of your insight, then you just use them, as I keep saying, you keep using them in that way. How would you say infinite patience, boundless compassion in Thai? You could write to me that. Someone figure it out. Hey, boss. Someone write to me, then I'll figure it out. Okay. During meditation, when knowing the thinking mind arises and asking who is thinking, then what should we do next? Aha! This is the good question, because there's nothing to do next. There is no next. And the thing is, that's why I say in the question, you're not trying to find an answer. Right, but because we are so embedded in the doer, rather than like we are more embedded in the perception of the knower rather than knowing, the doer, the instrument, the kind of person, right, who does this, that there's always a sense of me doing something to get somewhere. And that's the whole project, is to no longer do that and just to awaken to suchness, to the way things are. And that's what Tathagata means, such realized. Huh? And so when you have a feeling, okay, I did that. Who's thinking? And the mind is silent. That's the blankness that the reading we had before is talking about. There's nothing there. Now what do I do? And that's tanha, not happy with peace. Tanha is saying, boy, this is boring. Give me something to do. Right? And so then what next? Which you could say, who am I? Then what next? Who am I? What next? You know, it goes on and on. But if you can then come to that blankness or come to that quietness, right? And that's the test. That's where the itching will come up. And so the what next is actually the itching. And then you say, oh, this is what next feels like. And then you come to the timeless. So tanha, or self, is in time. I am someone who is going somewhere and I will achieve something. Whereas knowing is not dependent on time, just knows. It knows time. So that's actually a very good question, because that's the misunderstanding someone has around that technique. And those are again moha characteristics, where the subtlety of tanha are becoming arises and you have a doubt. And you don't see, and it is a kind of dukkha, isn't it? It's a subtle kind of dukkha of not being satisfied with the way things are. So you look at, oh, what's the dukkha here? What's the dissatisfaction? What does it feel like? And you wait. And then the tanha ceases. So these practices become, they have many subtle levels, many, many subtle levels. All right. And that's it. Yeah. Okay. So I think Sasufi, is that good enough? Okay. So let's call it a day, or a night, or whatever.